I didn't want to preach this afternoon to you friends who might be here. I wanted Mr. Epp to do it. I thought he should. I wanted him to. I argued with him. But now you can see who's the biggest. So I hope it'll not be a bore to you, but a blessing to you. Now I'm going to ask you, so that you can tense yourself, I'm going to ask you for 30 minutes. It's 5 minutes after four. I will not be done at 25 minutes to five, but I'll quit then. I would not be done in 30 hours. The subject I have this afternoon should have 30 hours rather than 30 minutes. And I'm not facetious about it. I can preach for 30 hours on it, perhaps not with too much profit, but I could do it. This is a question that I want to ask you, and I'm going to consider it in a rather frank mood. It's at least interesting, if not indicative, that the first question asked by man, at least recorded, is, "Am I my brother's keeper?" I do not need to tell you who said it, I'm sure. If you're here and do not know that Cain said this about Abel, I suspect that you will not get too much out of what I have to say today. And I want to raise that question. I'm going to paraphrase it and ask it like this. Does the unreached man have any claim upon me? Cain said, "Am I my brother's keeper?" Does the unreached man have any claim upon me? Now, I know with most of your background, you're screaming in your heart, "Why, of course." Well, just a minute. I want to ask some questions before you jump at conclusions. First of all, this unreached man is a man I have never seen. Now, some we might have seen. But I'm thinking today of perhaps just a little further than the man ran around about you. We certainly have our obligations there. But I'm going to reach out further than that. And I'm thinking of this unreached man as somebody that I have never seen. I have never been to his home. I don't know how many children he has. I don't know what kind of a disposition he has. Secondly, I did not cause him to be in the condition he's in. Whether he's rich and wicked or poor and wicked, I had nothing to do with it. Whether he's a good man, as far as the culture is concerned of his country or not, I didn't have a thing to do with it. I didn't cause him to be there. I didn't have it to happen. And perhaps if I'd have had my way, it wouldn't be so bad as it probably is. Then I ask myself, and you may ask yourself, is it my fault that he's in the condition he's in? Is it my fault that there are still lands where wives are simply cattle? Is that my fault? Did I pass the laws? Did I bring it about? Is it my fault that children are raised in homes where they are simply instruments of vengeance for the parents, where they beat them and sometimes kill them at will? And I could give you instances of this that's happened but recently that I have known about through my missionary friends. Is it my fault? Is it my fault that children are offered in some cases to appease the God? And this afternoon, sometime during the day, while we're worshiping God here, is it my fault that in some places in the world, they will go, some to the fire, some to the river, and there give their children to gods, the fruit of the body for the sin of the soul? Is that my fault? Did I say they should? Did I plan this? How then is it, have these people any claim upon me? Is it my fault that in New Guinea, women must mutilate themselves for mourning? They must come and lay their fingers down on the stone anvil and with a stone hammer cut their fingers off in mourning so that they must go the rest of their days, depending on how many relatives they've had die, some of them with no fingers, some with two gone, some with four, some with all gone. Is it my fault? Is it my fault that when some of the relatives die, the little boys in New Guinea have to come and stand while their ears are cut to ribbons and tossed in the fire to the appeasing of the gods? Don't those people have any sense? Don't they know better? Is that my fault? How stupid can you get? How ignorant can you be? Is it my fault that they live like that? Is it my fault that tonight, back still in the bush, somewhere there will be selected a human sacrifice, and he will be slipped up on, and there he will be captured and killed? Is it my fault? Did I write the laws? Did I hire the witch doctors? Did I do it? Am I my brother's keeper? And then you can have all the argument you want. Are they not as human as I am? Don't they know as much as I do? Do they not have the same response as I have? Shouldn't they know better than the things they do? And I have only touched the friends, as you well know. And then when you stop to think about it, there's another angle to this. And that is this, that they didn't ask me for help. Am I my brother's keeper when he doesn't ask me for help? He doesn't send out and flag me down and say, "Help, I want some help." Oh, yes. Upon occasion, we have a missionary that comes home and tells us about the situation, and I'm sure it's a true situation that occasionally exists, where they're saying, "Send us help. Come over and help us." But ladies and gentlemen, the truth of the fact is, and I have heard missionaries by the hundreds, and I have read missionary books, I'm sure, also by the hundreds, the fact of the matter is that we're generally met on missionary shores with keen suspicion and wishing that we would go home. In fact, in the early days, we were met on Chinese shores with this: "Go home, you foreign devils. We don't want you here." In fact, then you go back far enough and read in the early days, 1900s, of the Boxer Rebellions, and they slew our missionaries and have been doing it since until today. And I'm 48 years of age. I have missionary martyr friends on many continents of the world who were my schoolmates in school, who were my friends. And today they lay buried on soils of at least 5 continents who were my friends because of the fact that they preached Jesus. They were not wanted. They were met with cold stares, and they were met with the desire that you were not wanted. Will you please pack up bag and baggage and go back from where you come? We do not want you. Am I still my brother's keeper? Well, now, of course, you know what answer I'm coming to, I suppose. And yet, ladies and gentlemen, let me tell you that if you think everybody's going to come to the answer I'm going to arrive at, you're badly mistaken. Because we have already given our answer, and we have already answered, no, we are not our brother's keeper. That's as obvious as can be. So you have to bring it right down to a personal thing. Am I my brother's keeper? So finally, I cannot answer for you. I can only answer for me, and I'm going to do that. I say to you this afternoon that we are our brother's keeper. And you can pile on all this that I've said this afternoon. You can pile on top of that a great deal more. I know that. You can pile on this pious thing that we run into everywhere today. Well, don't we have enough heathen at home? Sure, and why do you remain one? You know, I never failed to get a kick out of the story about the usher that was taking a missionary offering, you know. And he had the basket on the end of a long pole like they used to take the offering. He was passing it along, and one old fellow there that was, he must have weighed 150 pounds too much, and he was sitting on both pocketbooks, you know, and he wouldn't move. He wouldn't get out a dime, and the old usher just kept shaking it under his nose, and he just kept shaking his head, and he kept shaking it. And finally the fellow said, "I don't believe in missions." And the usher just shook it again. He said, "Well, then take some out. It's for the heathen." And you can add that to all that. And then you come along to this pitiful, weak, anemic, spiritless cry we hear everywhere. We can't give to missions. After all, our building is nearly falling down. It might do you some good if it did fall down. Bless our hearts. And you heard Mr. Weiss yesterday quote, if you were here, the money we're spending and throwing into buildings, and we need good buildings. I'm not talking about that. If I had an extra hour, which I don't have, I'd talk to you about building. I have a few things to say about that. If when time goes by and the Lord doesn't come and we're covered over with the winds of time and the aborigines of some other time come and dig us out, they will think we were a strange gang from the churches they find when they excavate.
But let me tell you, all of that combined and all of this weak cry that if we give to missions and go to the ends of the earth, it'll hurt our program. In spite of all that, I say to you, we're still our brother's keeper. And I'm going to prove it to you if I can. There are several claims that are laid upon us. There is the obvious one, and it's the first one, of course. It is the claims that is laid upon us that are laid upon us, and this is the claim that is laid upon us by the command of the Lord. It's the old one. Go ye into all the world and preach the word to every creature. Now that demands that I be my brother's keeper in this sense. I take you on from there. Jesus said, a light shall not be hid under a bushel. People are still walking in darkness. And how we love to quote the verses. Oh, how we like to sing. Walking in the light, walking in the light, walking in the steps of our Savior. We just love these very things. And yet, is it fair that we dare to hide our light under a bushel? Jesus said, the harvest is white. Pray therefore the Lord of the harvest that he'll send forth laborers into the harvest. Why pray if the command has no claim upon us? Why not ignore it? There's not only the claim laid upon us, and because I pass over it in a hurry, make no thought that it isn't important. It is. I have laid the basis. The command of the Lord is one of the high things that says, I am my brother's keeper. But there's more. And the second one I lay upon us this afternoon, because it is laid upon us, is the claims of conscience. Now, don't stop and start arguing with me and say, well, now, just a minute. I'd like to have a definition of conscience. You don't need one. We have been defining too many things and taking our time to define things we know very well what means. And when I say this afternoon that there is a claim upon our conscience, every child can understand what I mean. He may not be able to give you Webster's Dictionary of Conscience. And I can, by the way. I've got it written right here. And this is it. Conscience is a feeling of right and wrong and a compulsion to do right. Now, we have that, ladies and gentlemen. We have a feeling of right and of wrong and a compulsion in us to do right. Why, yesterday or day before, was it, I read about in our, right here in Lincoln or close by, about this man who beat the children of the woman he was courting. Now, maybe I'm not sanctified. You just be the... But I'll tell you what I wanted to do with that fellow. I wanted to choke him until his eyes stood out like golf balls. Fellow like that. Now, I tell you, I have a feeling of right and wrong and some terrible compunctions about it. In fact, the matter is, I'd have liked to take a ping-pong paddle and used it on him till he looked like the description of the child in the paper, black and blue all over. I remember when we moved to California about 3 years ago or so, one night we wasn't acquainted with the community, and one night, way in the night, I woke and I was wakened by a noise. And I listened, and it was a baby crying. Just crying. Just, oh, only as a baby can cry. It was just putting it on. And I laid there, and finally I broke out in a cold sweat, and I began to think, what's wrong with those parents? Great day. Why don't they get up and take care of that kid? Do you know how you think at night when you aren't in church? When you're in church, you say, why don't they think of that child? But I was in bed and I was thinking, why don't they take care of that kid? And the little tyke that I thought was a little tyke was just screaming unmercifully. It went on for 15 minutes. And finally, I got out of bed and said, I'm going to call the police if I stir this whole country. I'm not going to have this go on any longer. You see, I had a feeling of right and wrong and a compulsion towards it. Now, you'll be happy to know that it wasn't anything but an old tomcat, but... That's beside the point. The point was that my conscience was working. And I had a compulsion to do something about it. Now, you see, that's the thing. Now, to have a conscience is important. And Paul says we can sear our conscience, and we've done it. It's important. The conscience is important. You see, if you have no conscience, then you live like animals. We occasionally have family prayer in our family. Now and then we pray together, depending upon the situation and the occasion. And we had a little dog given to us by a family here in Lincoln. We raised this little dog, and it was trained whenever we had family prayer. It just sat over on one side and made no noise, very quiet. But you know, that dog never once, when we were having prayer, talking about to God about the world, that dog never once got excited about the dogs in Africa and the dogs in China and the dogs in South America. He never uttered one peep, and we didn't expect him to. But ladies and gentlemen, let me tell you this afternoon, we're not dogs. We have consciences. And therefore, what happens to the people in China, and what happens to the people up and down Africa, and what happens to the people in South America, and clear into the north among the Eskimos, it does affect us. We are our brother's keeper. Now, conscience tells me that I am no better than people in other countries, simply because I have been born with a silver spoon in my mouth and a brick mansion around me doesn't mean that I'm any better. Conscience tells me that I deserve no more than they, and that if I have it, it is for a purpose. The soul of the black man on the selling block is as precious as the white man in the bidder's box. The man in the cart is as precious as the man in the car. The savage in the tree is as precious as the savage on the 10th-story building. Conscience tells me some things. Conscience tells me that the man who does not have my skin color or my abilities or my culture still feels exactly like I feel. He still thinks like I think. He still hurts like I hurt. He still desires like I desire. He still needs help as I need help. So my conscience tells me that my brother has a claim on me. He has a claim on me. And then there's the claim of opportunity and convenience. Why, ladies and gentlemen, we have never lived in a day like this. You kids, you know, you hear your parents talk once in a while about the good old days. Don't let them kid you. You're living in them. These are the good old days. These are the best days I've ever lived in. There's 40 of those good old days they were telling about were the days when I had to wear my mother's shoes to school. You can't blame me if I'm a fighter. I had to learn to fight to live. The kids made fun because I wore my mother's shoes. And what else could you do but poke them in the nose? You're just born. You're raised to survive. That's all there is to it. And so these are the good old days. We've never had it so good. I don't know how long it'll last, but I'm talking about this. For instance, we have opportunities given us by transportation. There's no place in the world now that, well, you'll have to ask Brother Epp for sure, because he came home in just such a short time from clear on the other side. Ceylon, if you go right straight through the world, any direction you go, Ceylon is as far away from here as you can get. Whether you go over the top, east or west, that's the ends of the earth. And I don't know how quick he got home, but the ends of the earth is hardly anywhere anymore. You can be there in just no time at all. And we have some responsibilities laid on us by our opportunities. The difference in communication than we used to have. And now the translations that we have. People who have given themselves machines that have been invented for printing. And now how we can spread the word and have it translated in no time at all. Ladies and gentlemen, this didn't happen. This came about because God is making an effort to reach the ends of the earth. If I didn't believe this, I wouldn't be where I am today. I believe this with all my heart. So that today we're busy laboring, but we don't know why we labor. You see, now we have money to use for God. And the world has a claim on us because of our prosperity. We're the rich people in the world. And our money wasn't given to us because we were so nice that the Lord just couldn't help but bless us. Our money was given to us because God has blessed us with freedom. And God has blessed us with sense. And God has blessed us in so many ways. And now God expects us to take His blessing and to divide it to the ends of the earth. And now He's made it possible so we can. I am convinced of this as I live, that if we would take today the opportunities laid in our hands, we could evangelize the world in one generation. I am convinced of it. I am positively sold on it. If I had time, I could turn to you this afternoon and tell you some of the things that could be done. But they're not being done because we're too simply too selfish. That's all there is to it. Now then, someone has figured out that we are 60% more selfish today than we were in 1933. I do not know. I am reading somebody else's figures. But he figured it out. You see, we've had an increase in giving. But we've had such an increase in being given to us. We haven't gotten more liberal. We've gotten more selfish. And if we were giving at the same rate we were giving per capita for income, we would be giving 60% more than we're giving now. You see, my father tells a story, and he was not a Christian, and I don't know if it's true or not, tell you the truth. I've never been able to check it, but he says that years ago, Billy Sunday came to this town to preach. And he preached out the fairgrounds, and that he asked $50,000 for coming. I don't know if that's so, and I've never been able to check it, but my father says it's so. Of course, sometimes, you know, those on the outside don't always tell the truth. But the rest of the story is interesting. He says that when Billy Sunday finished preaching, he said, "Now you've heard that I asked $50,000 to come here." "That's right, I did." So the story was told to me. He said, "And not only that, but I am leaving it." And he designated certain places here in the state he was going to leave it. And he said, "I want you people to know, those who were sitting out there listening, and maybe some of you were there, I do not know, but it's reported to me that," he said, "I want you to know that I'm worth more than any old racehorse that runs around this track. And I think that's a pretty good thing." And was it yesterday that the Kentucky Derby was running? It was all over the papers, and you turn your TV on, and they were all Kentucky Derby'd. And so they run a horse around there, and around $200,000 changes hands just because some old nag got the head start on the other one. And then we say, "My, aren't we doing wonderful?" Well, it is wonderful, all right. It's amazing. Now, I'll tell you, something has happened. It is possible for us to let material things take the place of the spiritual in place of using our material things in a spiritual way. The material, you see, we can lose our sense of our souls, and we can lose the sense of the soul's needs of others. Ours is a solid, substantial, material universe in which knobs and push buttons have become the angels and are the servants of man's comforts. And so we send the cannibal a can opener and a can of horse meat and a tract on culture and let our conscience go to sleep. Took me 3 days to write that sentence. And that's exactly what's happening to us. So he has a Singer sewing machine and a filter-tipped cigarette, but he doesn't have the gospel. And it's because our consciences have gone to sleep. Now, we come to a place in this line where cottage is better than a mansion there, cottage here better than there, where a tin whistle to blow here is better than a silver trumpet over there, where it's easier to lay up treasure here where we can feel it than it is to lay it up there where we can only see it by faith. But the thing I want to say is that our opportunities lay claims upon us nevertheless. We are our brother's keeper. It's obvious. Then a couple more things and I'm through. Our sense of fairness lays a claim on us. The many things which I have, which they have not, the unreached. Oh, I'm not talking about my automobile. In fact, I was thinking about this today, and it came a story to me about one of the missionary sons down in South America. And the missionary had gotten a Sears Roebuck catalog. And he, with the little Indian playmates of his, were looking at the Sears catalog, and the little missionary boy was going through and saying, "Boy, would I like to have that? Boy, I wish I had that. Ah, I wish I had this." You've all done it. And the Indian boys were looking over his shoulder, and finally one little Indian boy tapped him on the shoulder and said, "Hey, who would carry it if we had it?" You know, we forget that everybody doesn't have to have everything we have. Wasn't it Epictetus who said to the young man, he said, "Young man, when you get," he said, "never get married. Because," he said, "when you get married, you're going to have a keg for your wife to sit on and a cup for her to drink out of. And the next thing you know, you'll be taken up with cups and kegs." You see, you don't have to have everything we've got. And so here it is, a sense of fairness. It's not that I'm talking about, but it's this sense of fairness. It's the sense of churches. We have churches on every corner. You have to hold your hands over your ears to keep from hearing the gospel here. You've got to keep your radio turned off or you'll surely hear it. But he has no church to go to. If tonight, if right now, in hundreds of tribes, literally hundreds of tribes, there came a stirring of the deep, intense soul of those people, and they said, "We're going out to hunt for the true God." They couldn't find him. Oh, I know you theologians will come along and tap me on the shoulder and say, "Well, buddy, don't you know if they seek, they shall find? They won't if we sit." Now, here it is, our sense of fairness. Here we have the Word of God. I have 8 translations. I don't know how many you have. I don't know how much you have. It's everywhere. A rag picker can own a Bible. You can buy them 2 for a quarter. You can't read them. It costs that much, but you can buy them for that. It costs you about $1 to buy a good one. Here we have literature. And then we have radio broadcasts. All of this. And people say, "I couldn't live without my church. I couldn't live without a radio broadcast." And I have only one thing to say. I'm so thankful you don't have to. I thank God for the churches. I'm so happy that there's as many as there are. Let them be multiplied. I'm so happy for the radio broadcast that preach the gospel. Let their number be legend. But let me remind you that while we have our churches and while we have our radio programs, there are literally thousands of people that have never heard one message and will not hear it from any kind of anybody, one word from radio, preacher, Christian, nobody. They've never heard it. And then we dare to stand and say, they've no claim on us. Ladies and gentlemen, their claims lay on us heavy and heavier. And then we have all these things. We have the hope of heaven and joy and bliss, the reunion. We have talk about angels and no tears and the city of God and green pastures and all of this. And by the way, for you Bible scholars, this is why we spend so much time in the 23rd Psalms. You got to be a genius to get missions out of 23rd Psalms. It's in Psalm 22 and it's in Psalm 24, but not in Psalm 23. That's why so many people are still there. They're just acting like sheep. Bah, give me some more green grass. And if I had an hour to preach to you on those three psalms, I'd like to do it, but I don't have time. Now I want to get this across to you, and I got 5 minutes left. You don't need to look at the clock. I'm watching it. The motives that drive us. The motives that drive us. What drives me as a Christian? First, the love of Christ constrains me. For the love of Christ controls and urges and impels me. Because we are of the opinion and conviction, says Paul, that if one died for all, then all have died. And in verse 18, here he tells us, and God through Christ gave to us the ministry of reconciliation, that by the word and deed we might aim to bring others into the harmony with him. That's our aim. That's the love of Christ. Mark it well, will you, so I can pass on quickly. The love of Christ. Second, I am motivated and controlled by the word of Christ. For the Lord is my Lord. If thou shalt confess Christ as Lord, thou shalt be saved. He is the sovereign, as Psalm 24 has him, and he has said, go. And he need say no more. You don't ask a king when the king says, gives a command, that's all you need. You don't stand and argue with him and say, your honor, sir, or whatever you call a king. I've never been around one, but whatever you call him, you don't stand and argue. He just simply said, and you're gone. And when the king says, go, that's all there's to it. That's the motive that drives me. The love of Christ. The word of Christ. Other sheep I have, them also I must bring. Then there is his inheritance in the saints. Oh my. The possibility that there is in people who hear the gospel. Did you ever stop to think of the possibilities in people still unreached? Here, look at these kids this afternoon. Brother, I tell you, I had notion to tell brother if I wasn't fit to preach. As these kids were singing, you know what I wanted to do this afternoon? I wanted to stop the meeting. I wanted to stop the meeting. And then I wanted to say to these young people, now just wait a minute. I have some friends I want to bring in. And then I wanted to start over in China. And I wanted to gather all the unreached Chinese together. Then I wanted to go down through old Borneo, Kalimantan now called, down to Bali on the south and across the isles. Then I wanted to go down through India and Arabia and over into Africa and down through South America and come back. And I wanted to set the Indians and the Chinese and the Indians of India and the broad seas of the whole islands. I wanted to sit them all down. And then I wanted to turn to the choir and say, now sing. I've heard so much of this music, and I've never enjoyed more than I enjoyed today. But great God, when are they going to hear us sing? They sit and chant in their minor keys and stir their fire with their sticks and feed their souls upon air. And we hear so much. And frankly, I don't mind telling you I'm ashamed clear down to my boots. I laid on my bed this afternoon and wept tears. And God said to me, what have you ever done? I said, nothing. How many cities have you ever reached? And I said, none. How many people have you ever won? I said, I don't think any. I've done so plagued little. And then I had to confess, and Lord, I'm not able to do a bit more. You're going to have to do something for me. And then I had to confess, and Lord, I'm not able to do a bit more. You're going to have to do something for me. You're going to have to do it. But ladies and gentlemen, it just isn't right. There's a sense of fairness that God has put in us that changes these things. And in 1 minute, let me give you my last one. It is the motive of time. You can say what you please, gentlemen and ladies, but time is a motive. Time drives me. The emergency of the thing. My generation. Not yours. You're not responsible for my generation, you young people. I'm a generation ahead of you. My generation. And time marches on, and they march out. And that's it. If I can see through my tears, I'd like to read for you a poem in closing. This day is thine, a shining gift from heaven, gleaned for thy use from treasures of time, given in trust to hold until the even. This day is thine, a charge sublime. This day is thine, to be what thou wilt make it, hidden in self or used in service fine. When thou shalt bring it back to him who gave it, what will it be, this golden day of thine? This day is thine, thy yesterdays are finished. Soon will the present join the changeless past. With its bright hours, will its bright hours be gathered for thy keeping, or by the dreaded rust of waste o'ercast? This day is thine. There may be no tomorrows. This day is thine. From dawn till setting sun, may thou at even, like a worthy steward, hear in thy heart the master's words, well done. Ladies and gentlemen, I don't believe an honest man can give but one answer to the question, am I my brother's keeper? And the only honest answer can be given, yes, Lord, I am.